And so now John Marsh Russell is going to talk to us about the Aaron of Boehm effect and its generalizations, also on the blackboard.
There is the question about how you realize in real physical systems all these fantastic properties of topological quantum computation. And a lot of the modern thoughts on this are based on an effect that was realized in the late 1950s, the Aronoff-Bohm effect, which actually has an extraordinary number of generalizations and applications, all the way to many condensed matter applications, but also precision measurements of very profound relationships that occur in our world, to even black hole physics. And if I have enough time at the end, I'll tell you about some of the applications even to black hole physics and things like that. So this is Boehm effect. Actually, the very first thing to say about the Aronoff-Boehm effect, and possibly this is the most important lesson of all, is it was discovered about 10 years earlier by two other people, Ehrenberg and Sidde, who didn't emphasize the importance of this result. They didn't realize the significance of what they had discovered. In fact, the lesson is if you do not realize the significance of what you've done, no one else will, and you will never get any credit. So this is so we should mention the other people. This is Ehrenberg and Sidde. And they have a mention of this in a paper, but then it was forgotten by the community. And it was really Aronoff-Boehm who emphasized. So what I want to start off with is one of the most profound and simple things profound and apparently simple things in quantum mechanics, which is the two-slit experiment. So here is our two slits. And we're going to do it with electrons. So what we're going to do is we're going to send in a beam, a plane wave of electrons into our slit here. And here we're going to have, over here on this side, we're going to have some observing screen. And you know what happens on this thing. Famously, what happens is you observe an interference pattern, which I'm not drawing very well here. Right. You draw a thing with a central maximum, and zeros, and then subsidiary maxima and minima at the other side. And of course, the way we can think about, the way that Dirac and Feynman said the way we can think about this particular thing is we can think about the electrons going on different paths, one path that goes to the top slit, one path that goes through the bottom slit, and they acquire phase factors, so e to the I s1 on h bar from this path, e to the I s2 on h bar on this path. Here they have e to the I s1 prime on h bar on this path, e to the I s2 prime h bar on this path. And what happens is you interfere, the interference you get depends upon, on this path, the product of these two phase factors, that means the sum of these two factors s here, because if you product two exponentials together of this form, you just add these numbers, and you interfere it with this path, and it has a different phase that's set now by the sum of s1 prime and s2 prime. And of course, it gives you this very profound fact that even electrons give you interference patterns. So the idea of the Aronoff-Boehm effect is let's add to this system, all right, the following thing. Let's imagine I have a long, thin solenoid. So here is a solenoid, right? And it contains some B-field in here, some B-field that points up. And let's say the total flux, that means if you remember your electricity and magnetism, that means the integral of the B field across this region here, this little surface here where the B field is non-zero. Let's say the total flux is phi. So this is the flux inside the solenoid. All right. And so now let me put, so I'm looking down on this diagram, so I'm looking down, and here is where I'm going to put the solenoid. I'm going to put the solenoid here. And what you find is you find, so I want to emphasize something to you, which is all the B field is inside the solenoid. To a very good approximation, no B field outside here in this region here. So there's no B field out here and no B field out here. That means as I look down on this picture, all the B field is here, right, and none of it is outside. Right? And what you find is you find as I change this flux, this pattern moves, right? I change the location of the maximum and minima. In fact, you change it in a periodic fashion. As I change phi, as I change the product E phi, the charging electron times phi, and as I go to E phi plus 2 pi, the pattern goes back to itself as it was before. So it periodically depends upon what's going on with this flux phi. Now this is very remarkable because everywhere the electrons are, there's no B field. In fact, we can make this a stronger statement. So I can shield this solenoid by very, very good shielding, something that exponentially damps the size of the electron wave function inside the solenoid. So I have exponentially good control about how much the electron manages to penetrate inside the solenoid. And actually, let me ask you a question. I did a physics lecture. So why did I assume the solenoid was very long? Why did I have to assume the solenoid was very long? Yeah, exactly. So what happens? A solenoid, one of the profound facts about our world is we see electric monopoles, in other words, sources of electric field lines, but we don't see magnetic monopoles. We've never seen such a thing. So these field lines here in B have to return somewhere. They have to be returned. So there is some B field outside that has to return. Everything that goes up here has to come back. So, but if I make this solenoid very, very, very long, the typical length scale over which these field lines return is set by this length, and so they're very, very, very far outside the regime of where I'm doing this experiment. So I can make the B field here arbitrarily weak. So what we find is we find a physical effect, I mean the position where you get the electrons dominantly appearing, changes as I change this flux, even though the electrons in a region where there's no B field and no E field. So let me emphasize that classically this setup, we should see no effect. Right? There should be no effect because we're in a region where E equals B equals zero. Right? Nevertheless, there is a physical effect, it's period and phi. So what is going on? Well, what is going on is you must think in terms, in quantum mechanics, of the potentials. So in particular, the magnetic potential. So if you remember a little bit of your electromagnetism, you can write B as curl of A. Another way of saying that is you can think about what this A field, that taking some derivatives, complicated derivatives, of A gives you B. And so what happens is outside the solenoid, there's circulating amounts of A. Right, so here's A circulating around. But again, I emphasize that in classical mechanics, in classical electromagnetism, in a region where there's no B and no E, all right, even if there's A there, in classical mechanics, even in a region if you have no B and no E, there's no force on the particles and the trajectories of the particles don't change. Here, we're seeing that, in fact, the trajectories do change. The interference pattern changes. So what is going on in this situation is, in fact, these Feynman, Dirac-Feynman-like phase factors here pick up an extra contribution. And the extra contribution you have is you have a new phase factor. So this is a contribution to S. So S changes to S plus some delta phi. So there's some new phase factor. Actually, I really should write it over H bar. There's some new factor, phase factor here. And this phase factor is the electron charge over H bar, the integral of A dot with the path. So you go on a certain path here, you integrate A along that path, right, and you multiply by E over H bar, and you get this phase. And so if I have this solenoid here, and the flux is coming out of the board, these A lines are circulating around. If I do the integral around this path here, I find a non-zero value of this quantity. And this fact quantity is in fact exactly E phi, and this relationship over H bar, and this relationship is from Stokes' theorem. All right. In fact, you can relate this B curl of A and do the various Stokes operations and you find this relationship in the flux. So what happens here is that in quantum mechanics it's not only E and B that's important, it's the magnetic potential that's important. The magnetic potential determines in fact the final interference pattern you get or the dominant trajectories you have in the quantum system. Now, there's some very remarkable aspects to this issue. So one of which is, imagine we thought about the electron taking a slightly different path here. Not this path that went straight, but we say took on this path here. Let's imagine we did this path. And let's ask about whether this phase here, this extra phase, is dependent on you taking this different path. Well, the extra phase, how can you effectively change from this path? Let's blow this up. So here is the original straight bit of the path, and now here's the curve thing I have, and I want to convert this to this. Well, I can convert this to this, so this was the original path, and this is the new path I want to be on. I can convert one to the other by doing the following trick. I add a path, I think of a path that goes like this, and then I add this path here, right? And so I take my original path, and I add this, a contribution, a new contribution comes from this path, and you see if these things are right next to each other, they cancel, and you only get this contribution being left. I mean, basically what I do is I generate this contribution. I start off with just this line here. I start off with just this straight line. I add this funny, you know, curved loop. And this cancels this, and I just generate this bit. Now, what you notice is, and I've drawn this carefully so this thing doesn't enclose the solenoid, the flux inside this loop is zero. There's no B field. There's no flux inside this loop. So the extra phase you get from moving on this path is zero. In other words, it doesn't care about exactly which path. As long, the only issue it cares about is whether the path encloses the flux or not. It doesn't care otherwise about which path you're on. So it measures, it's topologically sensitive, right? It cares about the topology of the situation, not exactly which path you're doing. So that's one extraordinary thing. So we're going to use this, obviously, for many applications. We're going to use this to get fractional spin and statistics. We can use it for topological quantum computation. We can use it to generate new quantum numbers on black holes. But let me ask you a question for a second, which is, imagine you were a physicist in the early 1960s and you'd read Aronoff Bohm's paper and you were thinking about writing the next paper that would get lots of citations. So any ideas about some generalization of Aronoff Bohm that might immediately appear? Any thought? So here's B and A. Any thought you something you might try? Any natural question that appears? At E. So in electromagnetism, what is E related to? It's phi. We also have the electric potential. All right. Let me not call it phi because I've used that for phi. It's V. Right? And in fact, there is an electric generalization of the Aronoff-Bohm effect. So in quantum mechanics, when a system evolves, we're used to it having an e to the minus et on h-bar phase factor. So now let me say you have a charged particle of charge q in a region where V, the electric potential, is not equal to zero. So now I get an extra phase factor here. I get an extra phase factor from this thing, just from the change, which is minus qvt, how long you're sitting it, over h bar. And in fact, this can be used to perform some remarkable experiments. So let me tell you about a remarkable experiment that's being done now by a number of groups around the world, which is, imagine I start off with the following situation. I build a region like this, a very well-shielded region. And here, I put on a cap, right, such that in this region V is not equal to zero, and here, to a very good approximation, V equals zero. And I send up atoms, right, and I want to emphasize atoms, so neutral objects, at least according to the normal thoughts, and I send them in quantum entangled states. So one atom, I shoot up, and it just falls, it goes on a normal parabolic trajectory, and then it just falls back down to Earth. And I split this state by using lasers, and I make the second set of atoms, which are quantum entangled, with the first. They go slightly larger trajectory. So the difference between these two things, there's a difference because they have different velocities, which you can compute in a phase factor. But they also, this atom is in the region where V is non-zero, and this atom is in the region where V is zero. And these states are quantum entangled, so there can be interference patterns between them. So what can this test? So the remarkable thing this can test is this can test atom neutrality, right, to extraordinary accuracy. So one of the most profound facts about our world is that the charge on the electron is observed to be minus the charge on the proton to incredibly high degree. Right? This is exactly minus one. If it wasn't for this fact, many things about biology and chemistry would not be possible, would be ruined by the very, very strong residual repulsions, electrical repulsions you get. So this fact is very important for the existence of our world as we know it. How well has this fact been tested? Well, this thing is known currently to 1 part in 10 to the sort of 19 or 20. So it's already well tested. However, using the electric version of our Bohm effect, this thing, the extra phase you get from these atoms in here, you can now test this thing to 1 part, potentially, in about 10 to the 30. So this is possible. And certainly they can test it to 1 part in 26. Right? That's going to be achievable in the next year. And we might discover something extraordinary. We might discover that, in fact, the electron and the proton don't have exactly equal and opposite charges. That would be a very deep discovery about our world using our Bohm. So this is one on a generalization. So let's think about a different use of our Bohm now. So as Steve mentioned, spin statistics, all right, is very related to these, well, it's directly related to these topological quantities, the phases you get by exchanging things. So let us think about the following situation. How could we build, so here's a two-dimensional plane, right? So how could we build a particle that has, let's say, fractional statistics? Right? These particles were named as anions by Frank Wilczek, right, who was one of the very early people to investigate this situation. So how can we try to build fractional statistics in 2 + 1 dimensions, 2 spatial dimensions, 1 time? So let's imagine here's our charge, and here's our charge. And let's imagine that somehow I can attach little solenoids to them. I can make a composite object, and this arrow now means like a little flux tube or a little solenoid. So not only does it have a charge, they both have charge Q, both have charge Q, they're identical, but they also have some flux phi, some flux phi. So they have both quantities, and they're identical. Okay. So statistics is the idea, again, and it's actually, I think, the reason why I wanted to save Steve's drawings and to redraw it, is I take two identical particles and I interchange them, and it's the phase they get on the interchange. Well, you see in this situation that if I start off with these two particles, and I want to emphasize these are, you should think of them as composites of a charge and a flux, right? As I interchange them, so I take this particle around here, and I take this particle, let me take the overcrossing like this, make sure you do this, and here's the final time slice picture. So I sort of braid them together like this, and here's their final position. What phase do they get by this interchange? And the phase you get is exactly this Aronoff-Bohm phase, because this charge is going around this flux here, and this charge is going around this flux here. They pick up a phase of their wave function, right, as you interchange this thing, and in 2 + 1 dimensions, this phase can be arbitrary. Right? So they pick up an e to the I theta phase, which is this e to the I q phi, right? And q phi does not have to be equal to pi. Normally, you know, in 3 + 1 dimensions, this number has to be plus or minus 1. So this has to be some integer times pi. But that's no longer true in 2 + 1 dimensions. You can build, that means you design condensed matter systems such that the low-lying excitations are effectively flux-charge composites, such that when you do this interchange, you pick up this topological phase and you change statistics. Incidentally, it's worth saying, as Steve mentioned also on this thing, this relation, which I forget where it is, somewhere on this board, maybe he erased it, maybe it was the one thing he erased, when he was saying he was being legal and honest about things, there's a relationship now between interchanging and twisting a single braid. This is a composite, so I can think of twisting it around in space, and that gives me an idea about what its spin is. And you get a spin statistics theorem. So not only do these particles have fractional statistics, they also have fractional spin, which is related by the, exactly these braiding relations you get. So you can use Aronoff-Bohm to give you this behavior. That's very remarkable. So how about further generalizations around Aronoff-Bohm? What else can you do? Well, one thing to be said about these phases. So at the moment, the classic Aronoff-Bohm effect, all right, is abelian. Right? What I mean by that is I get phase factors, and if I multiply phase factors together, phi 1 and phi 2, of course I just get the sum of phi 1 plus phi 2. And it doesn't matter which order I do this. Now this thing is equal to e to the I phi 2, e to the I phi 1. Both are the same. So the order at which I do these operations doesn't matter. It's only the total phase, and that doesn't care about this. This is an abelian group. But a natural thing to think about, which remarkably wasn't thought about until actually finally the 1980s, when I was in graduate school, is the non-abelian version of this. Right? So now these phase factors here, they now get replaced by matrices. So now these things become matrices. Right? So let me give you an example of a matrix that it might be. It might be the matrix which is 0, 1, 1, 0. Okay. So let's say I build a system where I replace this matrix, this phase factor, by this. This is the new version of e to the I phi. Right? Is this matrix operation. So this matrix, 0, 1, 1, 0, can, let's say, act on an up-like state, a 1, 0 state. And if I act with this state here, this transforms it into a 0, a down state. So you can do these, so in other words, using non-abelian Aronoff-Bohm, you can start doing non-trivial operations on bits. You can start moving them around in very unusual ways. But let me tell you something really quite extraordinary. Let me tell you another thing you can do with non-abelian Aronoff-Bohm. So let's imagine, remember all measurables in quantum mechanics become operators. So let me put a hat on for an operator, and let me say I have a system where the charge operator is 1, 0, 0, minus 1. Let's say this is, as you know, all operators, they're linear, they're operators, I can write them as matrices. So I can write this is the matrix representation of the charge operator. Right. That means Q acting on this thing, this particle in this way of thinking, gives me plus 1, let me put a Q there. So here's the Q, so it's plus 1 Q, 1, 0. So this state now represents a plus 1 charge, or plus Q charge state. How about Q, it's right over here. How about Q acting on this? Q hat acting on 0, 1. Well, now, if I act with this matrix on 0, 1, I now pick up a minus Q, 0, 1. So the down guy is a minus charge state, the up guy is a plus charge state. Okay. So now you can do the following thought experiment. So let's have now a loop, a solenoid, right, which is a loop, a closed loop. And let's say this closed loop is very large. In fact, this could be realized in astrophysics and cosmology. There could exist such closed loops of solenoid. They would be called cosmic strings. They carry some flux along their path. Okay. They can be astronomically large. So this can be hundreds or thousands or even millions of light years across. Okay. And now let me send, and my statement is as we go around this, as we take go around this cosmic string, this solenoidal loop, you have this operation, this matrix here. So let me call this matrix omega. So you have this operation omega here. So now we can ask what happens to a charged particle. Well, here is my charged particle Q. And now I take it, you should think of this maybe as hundreds of thousands of light years. So I take it slowly, very, 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 very far away from the string. And I come back, and magically it's become minus Q. Because it's been transformed from a plus Q state to a minus Q state by the action of this matrix here, this omega matrix. But total charge is conserved. Total charge is conserved in this world. So what happened to the charge? We appear to have lost 2 units of charge. Well, total charge is conserved, so it must be that somehow this loop has delocalized charge of units 2q. It must have, when you do this operation, even if you do this operation very, very, very slowly and keeping light years away from where the loop, where this cosmic string or solenoid in the sky is, it must be true that there has to be a plus charge q excitation you have. And because you can do this operation very, very, very slowly, the only scale in the problem is this length of the loop. So it must be that the mass of this excitation, this mass of this 2q thing that somehow you're exciting, must be parametrically, right, 1 over, let's call this size L, 1 over L. And again, this is an astronomical length scale. So if you convert this into mass units, this is some incredibly tiny. This is, you know, way, 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 way less than, say, the mass of the proton, the mass of the electron. It's an exponentially almost tiny, tiny mass. So there must be very, very funny, if you had such a funny cosmic string, there must be very strange behaviours where you can start having very, very light, charged excitations, which you can't say are localised anywhere. They somehow exist in this whole space. It's a thing which is a property of the whole loop, not of any individual part of the loop. So these strings, such strings, which occur when you have, these strings, not surprisingly, are called Alice strings. Exactly, it's a good name. And any guess about what kind of charge this funny charge is that's not localized anywhere is? Another thing associated with Alice? Well, I think Sydney came up with this, Sydney Coleman. These are called the Cheshire charge. All right, if you remember. So these are Cheshire charge excitations of cosmic strings that could exist in the world, and they're due to this non-abelian version Aronoff-Bohm effect, which has matrices acting, not just phase factors acting. So how much time do I have left? Who's doing time? Oh,
well. You've got about 10 minutes.
Okay, very good. So let's do another interesting aspect. So let me tell you another fact about the Aronoff-Bohm effect, which is very extraordinary. So, of course, in electricity and magnetism, the mass of the photon is zero. Right? The mass of the photon is zero. That means we have electric and magnetic fields which die off just if you have some source, just like 1 over r squared. Right? So we just have like normal Coulomb's law. This is unusual. You see, the Aronoff-Bohm effect doesn't depend upon E and B fields being present in a region. It only cares about the potentials, either the electric potential for the electric Aronoff-Bohm effect or the magnetic potential. And they don't have an energy cost. So you could ask yourself whether it's really essential for the Aronoff-Bohm effect to have the photon mass be zero. Could there be a generalization of this thing? So in fact, that is true. You can imagine a world where, and it could be our photon or some new photon, some hidden photon maybe associated with something like dark matter or something else like that. You could take the photon mass to be non-zero. And this would say that electric fields would now die off like e to the m gamma times r over r squared. This is how electric fields would die off, and similarly for magnetic fields would die off. They'd all be screened, right? In some similar way, they would exponentially die off. But A's and V's could be non-zero. But A's and V's, these potentials, non-zero, right? Just polynomial, just going like some power of the appropriate power of 1 over r to the n with no exponentials. So you can have regions even when the photon is massive. So this leads to a new possibility. This, as you know, the photon, right, is the force carrier of what's called a U1 gauge theory. Right, this is what it is, a U1 gauge theory. It's a force carrier of U1 gauge theory. We could make this photon mass, though, arbitrarily large, and we could still have Aronoff-Bohm phases exist, because it doesn't depend upon the E and B fields. So we can have a theory where apparently, right, no photon, so no light particle, no electric or magnetic fields you can directly think. So you could have a theory with no photon, but still Aronoff-Bohm phases. Okay. So let me give, so what would you do with this? So how would you tease such a thing? So let's imagine we have a charged object. So here is my charged object. This is now charged, and I'm going to put quotes, under Aronoff-Bohm. All right? And I'll tell you what I mean by that. So here is my thing. This object, all its electric and magnetic fields die off exponentially. So the electric and magnetic fields, again, are dying off like e to the some photon mass times r over r squared. They basically don't go outside at all of the object. So out here, you don't see any sign this was a charged object. Out here, this appears to be a completely neutral object. But now you can do the following thing. You take one of these type of strings here. You can do the following object, and now it's going to topology that comes in. So here's our object. Right. And let me take a little string. I imagine the quantum interference process, or the quantum process, where I pop out of the vacuum a little loop of string. So I'm drawing different stages of time here. So this is at time equals 0. I pop it out of the vacuum. This is, say, time equals 1, time equals 2, time equals 3. Then it starts shrinking back down. Time equals 4, time equals 5, time equals 6. It goes back to the vacuum. Right, so I take this string, and what happens is I have to surround this object. But now this process picks up this Aronoff-Bohm phase. This probability of this happening occurring depends on e to the I, well, in the abelian case, e to the I theta, the Aronoff-Bohm phase. All right. And I emphasize, without you ever having any long-range fields or anything like photons around, anything you can see by other means, this means that there can be secret quantum numbers for particles, secret properties of the particles in principle, you can't detect by any other means than these funny processes where I take the particle and surround it by a kind of solenoid, a cosmic string or something like this. So this means they are new quantum numbers. All right. Again, they are discrete, and I can gauge quantum numbers. All right. Associated with objects, with particle-like objects. So this is an interesting observation. Let me tell you why it might be particularly interesting, which is the following. So one of the areas, as Andrew mentioned, I mean, there's one area where we have some reason to worry that quantum mechanics might be breaking down, the rules of quantum mechanics might not be true, and that's the area of when you try to combine quantum mechanics with gravity. Certainly, we certainly don't fully understand that system. And in particular, the most extreme gravitational system is a black hole. Right? So black holes, for many years, there's been great mysteries about black hole properties when you try to think of them quantum mechanically. And one of the reasons for that is that, so if you have a black hole, all right, if I have a black hole, well, these systems have what's called, they have no hair. Right? Black holes have no hair. So what does no hair mean? Well, actually, it doesn't really mean no hair. Black holes have just a few hairs. So if I have, here's a black hole, and it has some size called the Schwarzschild radius. So this is RS, the Schwarzschild radius. And imagine I'm doing experiments in this region far away from the black hole. So what properties can I measure of this black hole? Well, I can certainly measure its mass. That affects how planets and stars and other things orbit around it. I can measure its angular momentum, its direction, because if this black hole spins, it actually changes the shape of the gravitational fields out here and changes the orbits again, so I can measure that. I can also measure its electric charge, let me put EM to emphasize this electric charge, because if this thing carries charge, then it has electric fields that sit outside the black hole, and I can see how charged particles are changed in orbits. But that's it. I can't measure anything else than this. So, in fact, there's just three kinds of hair that a black hole can have, according to the usual theory. And the reason why there's only these things is the only massless particles we have around in the world are gravitons and photons. And so the graviton gives these two pieces of information, and the photon gives this. But this is thinking classically, and the world isn't really classical. So one of the mysteries about black holes is that you can appear to create a black hole in very, 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 an exponentially large number of different ways. But the final properties of the black hole are described by these three quantities. So where did all the information go about how you created it? This appears to be, you appear to have lost information in this black hole. So one of the issues is there's so few things that distinguish a black hole. The black holes are only characterized by these things, according to classical theory. But then this fact comes in. So the point is you can quantum mechanically have a situation. So let's say we have some new U1. So this is some new photon, some new analog of electromagnetism. But you give it this new photon, let me call it photon prime, has a non-zero mass. Let's say it's very large mass. So it's no long-range fields. Its fields die exponentially. In fact, you can show that they don't go outside the Schwarzschild horizon at all. In fact, you can show the electric fields under this prime thing here in this region outside the black hole are exactly zero, interestingly enough. So they're exactly zero. So there's no classical experiment you can do that tells you a black hole would be secretly charged under this new force. But Aronoff Bohm comes to the rescue. So now you can do exactly this thing. I take a cosmic string loop, I take some loop around, I let it go around, and I now pick up a phase factor, which is e to the I, the charge under this new thing, and the flux, let me call it phi prime, that's carried by the cosmic string under this new thing. And this can be non-zero. All right, this can be, not equal to one. All right, it can be non-trivial. So you get new pieces of information that just don't appear in the classical theory that characterize black holes. In fact, there can be a very, very large number of such pieces of information, because there can be many, many of these factors. There can be non-abelian versions of these factors. There can be a tremendous number of hidden properties of a black hole you can't see classically. That's the good news. Let me be, again, truth in advertising. The bad news is this does not solve the information paradox. The information paradox of black holes requires you to have a truly exponentially large number of new things that characterize a black hole, and this is not. This is basically polynomial. So it only goes a little bit of the way towards explaining what the quantum mechanics of black hole, but it does tell you that there can be surprises about the quantum behavior of black hole versus the classical behavior of black hole. And it's just due to the Aronoff-Bohm effect. The Aronoff-Bohm effect has an extraordinary number of applications, from fractional spin statistics, topological quantum computation, precision measurements of charge neutrality of atoms, to very, very strange behaviors of astronomically large or astrophysically large objects in our universe, to questions, of course these are thought experiment questions, but they're profound questions, about what is the quantum nature of objects like black holes. And it's all related to the fact that Aronoff-Bohm is topological in nature. Okay, so I'll finish there. Thank you.